KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The PC gave us computing power at home, the internet connected us, and mobile let us do it pretty much anywhere. Now generative AI lets us communicate with technology in our own language using our own senses. But figuring it all out when you're living through it is a totally different story. Welcome to Leading the Shift, a new podcast from Microsoft Azure. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger. In each episode, leaders will share what they're learning to help you navigate all this change with confidence. Please join us. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hilton brings you new ways to stay. With experiences, we'll let you capture the glory days. Introducing the Graduate Hotels. Each inspired by local college towns, these stays are always original and never boring. Get in touch with traditions all across the country and enjoy a stay that's a class above the rest. Book at Graduate Hotels with Hilton Honors Points at Hilton.com. It's a win-win. Hilton, for the stay.
One of the most significant science discoveries of all time would be that of alien life. And recently there's been an exciting discovery bearing on that. A team of astronomers detected a possible biosignature in the atmosphere of a planet 120 light years away. But despite the excitement, there's an uneasy undercurrent about NASA. The discovery was made with a NASA telescope at a time when the space agency's budget could suffer historic cuts, forcing the cancellation of several major programs involved in the search for extraterrestrial life. Well, what would the elimination of this funding mean to the hunt for alien life and other fundamental science research? Welcome to Big Picture Science. I'm Seth Shostak.
I'm Molly Bentley. In this episode, we hear about the intriguing discovery made with the James Webb Space Telescope, take a look at proposed NASA budget cuts, and find out what the loss of one program, the Mars Sample Return Mission, would mean for science. This episode is called NASA Under the Axe.
If enacted, the cuts proposed by the White House to the NASA budget would be the largest in the agency's history. They would slash funding by 25% and cancel some major programs.
Those programs include the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, which would study dark energy and exoplanets, and the Mars Sample Return Mission, which is just what its name implies. And the cuts don't end there.
Artemis III, our plan to send astronauts to the moon for the first time since Apollo 17, would survive, but future moon missions would be canceled. The Gateway Orbiter, a lunar space station, canceled. The Space Launch System, meant for missions beyond Earth's orbit, eliminated. And the Orion spacecraft program, featuring the vehicle to be used in trips to the moon, would be terminated.
The cuts would also undermine years of progress on a planned exploration of Venus by ending the agency's much-anticipated Da Vinci mission. That orbiter and probe would, among other things, look for life in the atmosphere of our sister planet. It's a lot to discuss, so let's get to it.
My name's Leonard David. I'm a space journalist.
So, Leonard, just how big are the proposed cuts we're talking about here? I mean, are we talking millions of dollars? Are we talking about billions of dollars?
Well, when you add them all up, if you're reading the tea leaves, which unfortunately we're in a tea leaves reading situation, it looks like billions of dollars of programs. It would be a dramatic and drastic cut into NASA space science.
Okay, so we could be talking about 24-25% cut to the NASA budget. That's a significant fraction.
Yeah. The thing that I come back to in my mind, frankly, is, you know, NASA has always been discretionary funding. And what does that mean to the American public? Discretionary means, well, you don't have to have one. You don't have to have a space program if you don't want it. What's going on with other countries? Do we have to have a leadership role? So all these proposed cuts that people are so concerned about do lead into a sequence of worry about American leadership in space after 50, 60 years of doing incredible things in space. Are we really going to pull back?
Can you name some specific programs that are at risk to sort of, you know, color this in for us a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about crosshairs on the Mars sample return mission. That's been the holy grail of space science for a long time, and that may go. We're talking about the Roman Space Telescope that's pretty much almost done as far as construction at Goddard Space Flight Center. And there's some rumors about even cutting Goddard Space Flight Center out of the NASA chain of agencies. So there's a whole litany of potential things. And frankly, the main thing that we got to be concerned about is how much will Congress come back and put those cuts back in? And how much of a fight are we going to see in the next few months?
Yeah. Okay. Well, then let me ask you the obvious question. I mean, there are going to be people out there, I occasionally encounter them, who will say, well, look, you know, why should my tax dollars be funding these rocky jockeys and their experiments? I mean, a lot of them are basic research, and from the public's point of view, basic research has no immediate practical application. What's your reaction to this?
Well, you know, I've been engaged in debates with people for a long, long time. Clearly, there's no winner here. You have to have a spark of interest and exploration of the good that going into the unknown provides. And NASA has been exemplary over the decades of uncovering, you know, new science, new questions, new understandings. And to me, that's valuable. As a kid growing up, I couldn't think of any agency that has done more for my interest in the universe than NASA. And other people, it's a ho-hum activity.
Do you ever retreat into saying, well, look, we've had a lot of technical spin-off from the space program. Even if going to Mars doesn't interest you, you know, the development of the technology for doing that influences your life. Is there something to be said there?
Yeah, I think that's one element in a big, you know, kind of a rotating wheel of fortune that NASA does provide incredible stimulus to low weight, low cost, biomedical sensors, you name it. I mean, anybody that has time to read the NASA spinoff documents can get a sense of the output that comes out of exploration, whether it's Mars or beyond or whatever it is, there's a lot of technology that does flow out of that. So, right. I'm with you on that. I do think the technology that we gain by exploring space is unique and world class.
You mentioned the Nancy Roman Space Telescope. I believe it's nearing completion. It's almost built, right?
They're a couple of years away from launch.
Well, I mean, is there any chance that we would abandon it? We would just, you know, leave it in a closet somewhere?
Well, I think you can find projects that were left in the closet in the past. So who knows?
And if somebody on the bus next to you said, Nancy Roman Space Telescope, what does it do for me? What does it do in general? What would you say?
Well, you know, it's another one of those in-orbit capabilities that is going to expand our understanding of the universe at a time when even today there is all these exoplanet detections that are coming right and left. I mean, even today were some fairly significant new findings about exoplanets that potential for life in the universe. And the Roman Telescope fits into a toolkit for astronomers. And meanwhile, the ground-based astronomy is going gangbusters. So the collision between ground-based and space-based capability is going to be totally different in the next few years if these things like the Roman Telescope get up there and operating.
Just to be clear, I don't know whether any ground-based astronomy, that is to say, telescopes on the tops of mountains, for example, are funded by NASA. I think they only do space-based telescopes. Am I correct in that?
Well, I think they're, if I read the tea leaves there, they all go back to the National Science Foundation, which is in trouble already by the Trump administration. It's being cut. And so how all these ground-based capabilities are going to be inhibited by funding cuts, that is another concern by a lot of the astronomy community.
Leonard, we're talking here, at least partially, about basic research with no, direct application visible. No, it's not obvious that basic research, which would be, just to trying to find out what's out there in the universe, for example. What do you say to people who say, look, basic research is maybe a nice thing in theory, and a lot of it is in theory, but we don't need that.
Well, I think it's more of a understanding dynamics of the unknown. Where are the edges of the unknown? What do we know? What do we don't know? We're tossing out to the moon. We're tossing out to Mars, Europa, instruments that are really gathering collective information about the makings of these worlds. And to me, one of the things that I always come back to when I write about the moon is that we're not even sure where the moon came from. I mean, we sent 12 people there at $25 billion in then-year dollars, and we're not even sure yet how the moon got there, how it formed. And so we're sending instruments for learning how to operate on the moon. But, to me, the moon is sort of the Seward's folly of the 21st century. It's a place where, like Alaska, we didn't know when we bought it what the goods of that territory were going to really come to be. And so for me, I like that. I mean, there are people that don't. They don't want to spend the money on the unknowns. But for me, that's what it's all about.
Well, getting back to the nuts and bolts of this, or maybe I should say the nickels and dimes, we're talking about a 24-25% cut to the NASA budget. Have we ever seen a cut of that magnitude before?
Everybody that I'm talking to that, and again, I'm a survivor of 3 decades of Washington, D.C., I don't remember any moment this severe.
What will NASA still be doing?
Well, there are people that are very concerned, already call it the Dark Ages. We're entering some kind of unique time. I had a space policy expert tell me the other day that's been monitoring the Washington, D.C. scene for decades. It's uncharted territory. Don't know what's going to come out of all this.
There will be, of course, people who would say, look, the government doesn't need to do all this. We've got companies like Blue Origin or SpaceX and so forth, and maybe they should just pick up the gauntlet and, get the government out of this business.
Well, that's happening. I mean, we're seeing a huge, I think since we started talking, probably about 50 startups in space have begun. I mean, people are creating these new companies right and left. Unfortunately, by and large, they're depending on the government to foot the bill for their early ideas. And we'll see how much of a commercial foothold they really have by other people buying their services.
Yeah, well, Leonard, okay, I can imagine some private companies are going to be happy to get into the rocket business, maybe even the launch business, but I doubt that they're going to get into the research business. That may not, improve their bottom line.
Yeah, well, there's two things that are going on. One is the private Venus mission underway between MIT and Rocket Lab. And whether or not they can send a probe to Venus to do some exploratory research in the upper atmosphere of Venus. Sarah Seeger and her team are making good progress there. The other one is disappointing because, in my view, the commercial lunar activity that NASA has signed up with private companies is a bit of a bust at this point. There has been too many failures already, and one success, a very fantastic success by Firefly, a private company that was hired by NASA to haul NASA space science experiments, and that was a tremendous first. However, Intuitive Machines have had skidding across the lunar surface two times and fallen over. That's not a good signal. So we're not out of the woods yet on the commercial viability of lunar exploration.
Well, then finally, you know, it might be that America's efforts in space are to a large extent, delineated by the public's attitude about space, right? If the public really wants more effort here, they can get more effort. But in a lot of other countries, it's all determined by the government. And consequently, they may see, you know, the opportunities or the threats of a space accomplishment that we don't. I mean, does this give us a kind of a permanent disadvantage when it comes to breaching the final frontier?
Well, you know, one hopes. You know, I think we got to be careful that we don't squander our leadership role after working so hard at it. I will say one thing that's starting to bother me more and more is that as NASA proves its capability, you know, you can make up almost any mission now and go, that is something, I can't believe we can do that, but they can do it. And now we're at a point when we can do so many things in space, but yet we're at a budget crisis. We're at a point of discussion about whether U.S. should even have a space program. To what degree does it fit into the diplomatic cornerstone of American policy? So you're asking the right questions, and these are way beyond my pay grade. You know, it is a citizen type of response that needs to take a look at our space program. I'd say be proud of it, and let's encourage more capability in the future.
Leonard David is a space journalist who has been covering space science for more than 50 years, starting when the Apollo missions were winding down and NASA launched Skylab, America's first space station. Well, Seth, what do you think of these proposed cuts?
Well, listen, you know, it's hard to argue, particularly with a taxpayer, about cuts to the budget. But on the other hand, when you're canceling programs, that's serious because you've already got a sunken investment there. You know, the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, I think that's already built. And not to, you know, put it on a rocket and send it into space is a terrible waste of effort and resources. So I'm not in favor of that sort of thing. Now, that's the economic argument, but, you know, fundamentally, this is basic research. We don't know what we're going to find with any of these instruments, but it's bound to be interesting, exciting, and also to give us some insight into what we should be doing in the future. You know, it's like throwing away our seed corn, if you will. It might not be terribly valuable to you today, but it certainly will be in the long term.
Next, what the loss of NASA's Mars sample return mission would mean in the hunt for alien life.
This is the mission that has the potential to answer that question of whether Mars was once inhabited.
We're looking at how the canceling of federal funding may affect science at NASA. This episode is called NASA Under the Axe.
The new McCrispy strip is here. Dip approved by ketchup, tangy barbecue, honey mustard, honey mustard, Sprite, McFlurry, Big Mac sauce, double dipped in buffalo and ranch, more ranch, and creamy chili McCrispy strip dip. Now at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
One of the programs that's eliminated in the White House's proposed budget for NASA is the Mars Sample Return Mission. This mission is supposed to be the next step in a series of rover explorations of the Red Planet, following in the footsteps, or perhaps I should say, the wheel prints, of Opportunity, Curiosity, and Perseverance.
While Opportunity last roamed Mars in 2018 after 15 years of hard work, Curiosity and Perseverance have lived up to their names. Perseverance, the youngest sibling, diligently collecting Martian soil and rock, has already explored the planet for more than 1,400 Mars sols, that is, more than 1,500 Earth days, or 4 years and 2 months. The idea behind the sample return mission was to bring to Earth what Perseverance had collected, making it the first Martian rock collection returned for study in Earth-based laboratories. It could revolutionize our understanding of the Red Planet's past and present potential for life.
Mars sample return is a joint mission between NASA and ESA, the European Space Agency, and is currently in the design and planning stages.
I'm Nadia Drake, and I'm a freelance science journalist.
Space science has long been Nadia's beat. She explains what we lose if the Mars sample return mission is scrapped.
Nadia, the Mars sample return mission is a program on the chopping block in the proposed White House budget. Now, does this mean that its elimination is confirmed or that its future is threatened? And what determines its fate?
Mars sample return is on the chopping block, which means that now it's up to Congress to decide its fate, because ultimately Congress gets to approve the president's budget request, which does zero out Mars sample return. In fact, the language, I'm checking my notes literally right now, calls Mars sample return grossly over budget, an unaffordable mission, and says that its goals would be achieved by human missions to Mars, which is why the president is proposing to zero it out.
How over budget is it, and how over budget can a mission be if it's still in the planning stages? I mean, no spacecraft has been built yet.
That's a really good question. In fact, actually, though, the first chapter of the Mars sample return program has been built, and that is the Perseverance rover, which is currently on Mars collecting the samples that we hope will one day be brought back to Earth. So the mission right now, well, last year there was a report that was put together which said that the anticipated lifetime cost of the mission is $11 billion, and that we would not have samples back here on Earth until about 2040.
Well, I want to talk about the science of the mission, but just one other question. Do you ever find it useful as a journalist to frame those costs in terms of what it costs the taxpayer per year? Because sometimes when we hear these big numbers, $5 billion, $11 billion, boy, that sounds like a lot of money, but what really does it cost the American public?
Oh, gosh, I haven't done the calculation, but it's really like cents per year. And the budget for the U.S. military is in the, what, trillions of dollars now? So it is absolute peanuts compared to everything else that we're spending. And, you know, you and I, when we pay our taxes, are not contributing very much to Mars sample return.
Well, let's look at this mission and why scientists, particularly those that study the possibility of finding life in the universe, have eagerly been awaiting it. What is it about the Mars sample return mission that has a lot of scientists excited?
Oh, there are so many things. But as you mentioned, when it comes to looking for life in the universe, we have, for a very long time, been obsessed with the idea that Mars is an inhabited planet in some way. And of course, our conceptions used to be more along the lines of those of Percival Lowell, who was imagining that there might be a planet-spanning civilization that was, you know, crafting large engineered structures to move water around. And over the years, our conceptions have shifted somewhat to think that perhaps early in its history, Mars was populated by microbes, maybe. And so this is the mission that has the potential to answer that question of whether Mars was once inhabited, and if so, by what kinds of life forms. And that's why we're really looking forward to seeing these samples back here on Earth, because when we have the tools that we have available here on Earth, we'll be able to look at these samples and see if there are signs of life in these rocks and, you know, perhaps answer this question that a lot of us are very interested in.
Let me follow up on that, on the advantages of having samples in hand and what that might allow us to say about Mars that we don't already know, because we've been studying Martian geology for a long time with our orbiters and rovers. So I know it's hard to say what could we learn that we don't know, because we don't know what we don't know. But what is it about having those samples in hand, Nadia, that might allow us to answer the possibility of life existing on Mars or the possibility of past habitability?
I love the unknown unknowns. Yeah. Some of the questions that folks have about Mars concern its evolution as a world. And so we used to think that Mars was perhaps once more habitable than it is today, that its surface was covered in oceans, that it had a thicker atmosphere. And we don't really know the timing of how that all shifted. And so one of the questions that folks hope to answer by having these samples back on Earth is, when did those shifts occur and why? And by having rocks here in the lab, we can do things like look at detailed isotopic analyses. We can look for the kinds of chemical signatures in the rocks that tell these geological stories and do the kinds of experiments that we can't do remotely. Because we can make a really good robotic geologist and send it to Mars, which is kind of what we've done with the rovers. But the tools that we have back here at home are much more powerful. And we'll have, you know, multiple teams of people looking at the same samples and you know, really putting the scientific process to work in the best way that we can.
I was interested to hear you describe Perseverance as part one of the Mars sample return mission. And the Perseverance rover, as we said in our introduction, has lived up to its name. It's been diligently collecting soil samples and rocks. Nadia, can you help us imagine those? What those samples look like? Do we imagine that the rover has assembled a pile of soil and rock the way that a child might make a sandcastle or something like that? Or has it been, you know, tucked away into containers in the body of the robot? Where is that sample right now?
In the first story I wrote about this mission, which is also called Mars 2020, I said that the Perseverance rover was going to be trundling around the surface of Mars and stuffing rocks in its pockets and just carrying them around. Which is kind of more or less what it has been doing. And it's a little bit more complicated than just like stuffing your pockets full of rocks, but it is collecting samples by drilling into rocks that the team has decided are interesting for various reasons. And then it puts that sample in a tube, a sample collection tube, and then those tubes get stashed in the belly of the rover. I believe it's the belly of the rover. And it has, in fact, already dropped off a cache of, I believe it's 10 samples that it collected, kind of as insurance in case the rover stops working before the next part of the mission arrives to pick up the samples. We don't want to go to Mars and have a rover that is totally powered down and we can't get to the samples that are inside it. So it has this, it's laid down this cache already on the surface of Mars as insurance.
If the mission is canceled, Nadia, what would it take to get it up and running again, possibly under another administration?
Ooh, it would require an immense force of political will, I think. And again, it's also possible that the Congress right now will not approve this budget as it is. And they may say, this is stupid. Don't cancel Mars sample return. You know, this administration seems to think that the goals of Mars sample return can be achieved by humans going to Mars. But sending humans to Mars and bringing them back is something that is so far outside of our technological capabilities right now. So I don't know if we lose this capability right now, I don't know if another administration is going to be able to find the support to bring it back.
So it feels like this administration is not prioritizing basic research, this kind of space science, but they do seem to be interested in sending humans to the moon and Mars, and something that you've said is currently outside of our capabilities. And Nadia, is that because of budgets or is that because it's an engineering challenge? Can you help us understand why it is that sending humans to Mars is a tall order at this point?
So it's actually not a tall order to just send people to Mars. We can do that. We can send them on a one-way trip. It's bringing them back that is the problem. And the problem there is, you can summarize that by just saying the tyranny of the rocket equation, right? It takes a lot of energy to get out of Earth orbit. That's why we have these gigantic rockets that have all of this fuel on board. It takes the same amount of energy to break if you want to land on Mars. So you've got to put a whole lot of propellant on your spacecraft. That makes it heavy. And mass is a problem. You don't want something that's super massive in space. And so imagine that you get down to the surface of Mars. Well, you've got your propellant on board that you use to get out of Earth orbit. You've got the propellant that you use to brake. What do you have left? You need a lot of gas to get back off the surface of Mars. And so right now, we don't have any spacecrafts that have that capability. And then so the other idea, which we've seen employed with the Apollo program, as well as the Mars sample return design, is like, well, okay, so maybe you have something that's in Mars orbit, which you're going to rendezvous with. You still need some source of propulsion. You have to make that other thing that you're going to rendezvous with. We have none of that right now. We have absolutely none of that built. So the idea that we're going to somehow put all of that together in the next, 4 years? Send humans to Mars within 4 years, to me, is just a ludicrous proposition. There's no way that we have the funding for that. There's no way that we have the technology right now to do it.
Is this a good time to do a shout out to all of the hardware that we put into space and the rovers and the kind of work that these instruments have done for us in exploring the solar system, how crucial they've been to our understanding of our place here in the universe? Can you say a few words about that? I mean, you don't need to send humans. We have robots that can do it for us.
We do. We have created over the decades a fleet of robotic explorers that have functioned as our eyes and ears, literally recording the sounds of other planets, and have helped us to understand the neighborhood in which we live, as well as the cosmic context in which Earth exists. We can explore our solar system robotically and beyond, right? The Voyager spacecraft have, quote unquote, exited the solar system, and they're now telling us things about interstellar space that we never knew before. And in 1977, when they launched, we never imagined that perhaps they would still be functioning now in 2025, but they are. So there's a lot to be said for robotic exploration. And I think I've always said that it would be a dereliction of our duties as a species to give up on that, to give up on trying to understand the cosmos that we inhabit. And we've done that very well, and we can continue to do that very well. We just need the will to do it.
Nadia Drake, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Nadia Drake is a freelance journalist.
Seth, any thoughts about the potential loss of the Mars sample return mission?
Well, yeah, because, it just sounds like, it's just another solar system mission. But it differs qualitatively in this regard. It's actually bringing a piece of the planet back to Earth where you can study it in a whole raft of different laboratory settings, things you can't do if you have to send the laboratory to Mars.
Well, you're someone who has thought about the possibility of life on Mars, or at least if life ever existed on Mars. Do you have a particular attachment to the Mars sample return mission?
Well, yeah, because it's the one that's, most likely, at least in the near term, to give us, if you will, more compelling evidence that Mars has or ever had life. And that's a big, big question for science.
Next, astronomers using NASA's James Webb Space Telescope make an exciting discovery.
It's called dimethyl sulfide, and here on Earth, we have it in the air as well, but the only source of it that we know of on Earth is life.
Has this NASA telescope detected evidence of alien life?
We're looking at how proposed cuts to NASA will affect the agency's ability to do science. This episode is called NASA Under the Axe.
Hey, Fidelity. How can I remember to invest every month?
With the Fidelity app, you can choose a schedule and set up recurring investments in stocks and ETFs.
Oh, that sounds easier than I thought.
You got this.
Yeah, I do. Now, where did I put my keys?
You will find them where you left them.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
What does the chemical dimethyl sulfide mean to you? Well, if you say not much, that's fair enough. But here's a brief sketch of that unfamiliar compound. It's volatile. Its odor has been described as similar to rotten eggs, or perhaps somewhat surprisingly, sweet corn. It's produced by marine phytoplankton. And evidence of dimethyl sulfide may have been discovered in the atmosphere of a planet about 120 light years away.
University of Cambridge researchers say they made this startling discovery while using NASA's James Webb Space Telescope to examine the atmosphere of the exoplanet K2-18b. The discovery has generated excitement about the possibility of life on another world.
The discovery is only the latest for the James Webb Infrared Space Telescope, which has given us an unprecedented view of the universe by allowing us to see further into space than previous telescopes and to study exoplanets and their atmospheres. We've long been interested in exoplanets as possible locales for life. New York Times science columnist Carl Zimmer wrote about the Cambridge findings and puts the discovery in context. But he also describes its implication given the current budget crisis facing NASA and its space telescopes. He begins by describing what the researchers discovered.
Well, they looked through the James Webb Space Telescope, and they were actually able to get a reading on the atmosphere of this exoplanet. And it looks, they say, like there is a chemical in the atmosphere of this planet. It's called dimethyl sulfide, and here on Earth, we have it in the air as well, but the only source of it that we know of on Earth is life, is algae in the oceans and some other organisms that can make it. So this might, these are scientists say, might be a sign that there is life on K2-18b.
So this is very exciting. And some of the scientists have said to you, I believe, and other reporters, that this is the strongest hint of biological activity on another planet that we have found so far. Now, is that the same thing as saying we have found evidence of alien life?
No, that is not the same thing. No.
Okay. Help us understand the difference.
Well, it's, you know, the way one expert put it, they said it's something, but it's still just a hint and it could be wrong. And so it's certainly something that warrants another look. And the scientists themselves at the University of Cambridge who published this paper, they themselves are saying, we are going to be looking at this planet more and we're actually going to be doing studies in our lab to follow up on this to really see just how plausible it is that indeed there is life on this planet.
Well, before we talk about some of the skepticism about the results, because in all good science endeavors, there is skepticism and pushback, as there should be, I wonder if you could say more about what exactly and how exactly these Cambridge researchers found this molecule using the James Webb Space Telescope. Like, how do you study the atmosphere and the chemistry of another planet?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that we can actually do this now. So this telescope is far out in space, which means that its images that it sees are not blurred by our atmosphere, and it can pick out, you know, these planets. Now, they can't look directly at the planets. This telescope does not allow for that. But when these planets cross in front of their star, the starlight coming from the star can pass through the atmosphere of the planet and then make its way to the space telescope, which can then actually pick up that light, can actually start to get potentially good signals about things going on in these planets. You can figure out how big they are, how heavy they are, and you can also get some clues about the chemistry of their atmosphere, because those chemicals in the atmosphere, they will sometimes absorb the starlight and then release it and, you know, change the wavelength of what you see in the space telescope. So in effect, you're seeing the color of the atmosphere.
There are other reasons why they were looking at this planet. I mean, they weren't looking at this planet thinking, okay, this planet might have dimethyl sulfide in its atmosphere. But as you said, James Webb can evaluate planets on a number of criteria: how big they are, how close they might be to their star. Can you give us some idea of why this planet was a target in the first place for the James Webb Space Telescope?
Well, this planet is very strange compared to the planets that we're familiar with in our solar system. It is sometimes called a mini Neptune or a sub Neptune. That's because it belongs to this class of planets that are much bigger than Earth and Mars and the rocky inner planets, but substantially smaller than, you know, Neptune, for example. It's sort of in between. And so scientists have been saying, well, what are these things? You know, are they, you know, just totally made of gas? Are they sort of gas mini giants, or are they rocky, or what are they? And so scientists who studied K2-18b were making models, and they proposed that it was a kind of planet that would be covered entirely in an ocean, a liquid water ocean, and with an atmosphere that was dominated by hydrogen. There might be other molecules in it as well. And so, you know, you think about that, you say, well, that's a relatively warm planet. It's got water. Like, that's nice if you're looking for a place where life might be. So then when they took a closer look at the atmosphere, when they saw this dimethyl sulfide, they said, oh, okay, wait. So, hey, if we've got this ocean, this liquid water ocean, maybe there are microbes in it that are producing dimethyl sulfide. Like this all fits together into a picture.
Let's talk about some of those caveats. Now, the researchers from Cambridge who made this discovery said that these biosignatures can only be produced by one thing on our planet, algae. If that's so, why would there be any doubt about the source of this chemical?
Well, we have to be careful about, you know, what we're talking about when we're talking about dimethyl sulfide as this possible signature of life. The fact is that if you look at the dimethyl sulfide that is in our atmosphere and you try to figure out where did that come from, that dimethyl sulfide appears to come entirely from biology. That does not mean that there is no way that you can make dimethyl sulfide without biology. So scientists can make it in a lab. That's not complicated. Like they know how to synthesize dimethyl sulfide from other molecules. Now, so then the question is, could you get dimethyl sulfide forming on a planet without life? Now, that is a different question, and we don't really know the answer for sure because, you know, like, what can planets be?
Okay, well, let me ask you then, how strange would that planet have to be able to have an abiotic source of dimethyl sulfide? Like, I don't know, would it have to be entirely made of sulfur, or what would this planet look like?
Well, this planet might have a particular, you know, combination of other molecules, like, I mean, things that people have never heard of. You know, in one study, researchers were using things like ethane thiol and ethyl methyl sulfide, you know, stuff we're not really familiar with, but stuff that could possibly be existing in one of these atmospheres. And they were finding that they could produce dimethyl sulfide under those conditions. You know, we also know that scientists have actually found dimethyl sulfide on a comet. So, you know, clearly dimethyl sulfide was somehow produced in whatever parent body was making that comet. Could comets deliver enough dimethyl sulfide to a planet to create an atmosphere with dimethyl sulfide in it? The Cambridge researchers said they really doubted that possibility. But, you know, some people don't even think that K2-18b is an ocean planet. So, you know, there's so many of the sort of basics of this scenario that are being debated.
It feels like we've been here before. This discovery has the feel for me, and you may feel the same, of the discovery of phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus about 5 years ago. And if you remember, scientists were very excited about that. Again, it was considered a biosignature, one that only life could create. And then follow-up observations failed to find significant amounts of phosphine in the atmosphere of Venus, and the excitement died down. Are there parallels here? Did I summarize that story right?
Yeah. No, I mean, there was a lot of excitement about this theory that the presence of phosphine on Venus was a sign of life. And then, you know, a lot of people said, well, maybe we can account for that in other ways that don't require us to imagine that there's life on Venus. And that's kind of where things have ended up until, you know, we get more data. You know, there's a lot of good reason to be sending more probes to Venus to find out more things about what is in that atmosphere. And, you know, it's one thing to look at it through a telescope. It's quite a different thing to be able to send a probe there. Unfortunately, with K2-18b, we can't send a probe there. But, you know, if there are bigger and better space telescopes in our future, then it might actually be possible to actually look at, directly at K2-18b and get a much better read on the planet. But we don't know if those space telescopes are actually going to fly.
And do you expect that we'll hear more about the planet K2-18b in the near future?
We might hear about K2-18b an additional viewing time, maybe next year. It really depends on when the next opportunity arises and when there's free time on the space telescope.
And we might not have a definitive answer. And so scientists and science journalists and even the public have to live in the valley where possibility and uncertainty mingle, where you have to make peace with maybe not knowing definitively, maybe getting closer to having an answer whether or not there's life out there.
No, I don't think so.
No?
Well, we could get much better information about planets like K2-18b if the next generation of space telescopes goes into space. But, you know, the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope has been built by NASA, and these kinds of observations are what it's expressly built for. It would do a better job than the James Webb Space Telescope. And in the proposed budget for NASA, it is canceled. So that's not a question of scientific uncertainty. That's a question of priorities, political priorities.
If you cut the funding to NASA's ability to do science, Carl, what does that cut? And then what's left for NASA?
The projects that would be affected would be the probes that we send to other planets, space telescopes that we could send into space to look at other solar systems and distant galaxies. It also will kill off a lot of the research that NASA, among other agencies, does looking down at Earth and looking at our own climate and our own atmosphere. And so a whole range of incredibly significant, historically significant kinds of research will be eliminated. What's left is, you know, it seems looking over the proposed numbers is mainly getting humans to the moon and to Mars.
Well, then finally, Carl, as a journalist who has reported extensively on life on this planet as well, and has written books about just the wondrous diversity of life on this planet and how it arose, what is it, I'm asking your opinion now, what is it you think we lose if we curtail our efforts to look for life elsewhere in the universe?
I think we curtail our chance to answer maybe the biggest question in science. I mean, are we alone or not? We could at least find out if there's some sort of life elsewhere in our solar system or other solar systems that might not be intelligent life or like us, if you consider us intelligent. It might be just microbes, but still, that would be a tremendous, tremendous discovery. And we could potentially do it. We have made huge strides in the past few decades in terms of the kinds of technology you need to figure out if there's life elsewhere in the universe. Everything from, you know, DNA sequencing to, you know, space telescope technology. We've got it, and there are more advances that we could make to get there to answer that question. So I think in terms of those fundamental questions that science can address, how did life evolve? What are the physical laws of the universe and so on? We would be giving up some of that.
Carl Zimmer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Carl Zimmer is a science columnist for the New York Times who reported on the potential biosignature discovery.
Well, Seth, what are your big picture thoughts about the proposed budget cuts to NASA, which could be up to 25% and include the loss of many major science programs? I guess what I'm asking here is, what is the value of exploration?
As an astronomer, obviously, I find exploration a very interesting thing to do, because that's what astronomy is very much about, not exclusively. Understanding how the stars work, for example, is not necessarily exploration. But when you're talking about our solar system, exploring it, you know, to begin with, it's just as interesting as any of the age of exploration missions, you know, from Lewis and Clark all the way to Magellan, were about too. Just to know what's out there, just to map the local universe is certainly interesting, but it also has, you know, repercussions into a really an indefinite future.
What is one discovery made by our rovers or our spacecraft in the last, I don't know, couple decades or so that is really memorable to you?
Well, I think perhaps the thing that sticks in my mind are those early photographs of the surface of Mars, where you could see layers, right? Just as the way you would see layers in any sedimentary rock here on Earth. And those layers tell you that, just like sedimentary rocks, that there was once water, extensive water, on the red planet. And, you know, where there's water, there might be life. So I found that a really exciting result.
What stands out for me recently are some of those images of Jupiter or the rings of Saturn that were just so sharp and magnificent to witness, even though we had some previous images of both those planets. And that is something that a NASA telescope brought us.
Yeah, well, just getting a telescope up above the atmosphere is what's required if you want a sharper picture of our own solar system, and now we have those. You should keep in mind that this is, you know, largely basic research. In other words, it's exploration. And not to do this, not to explore the unsampled parts of our own solar system, would be like, I don't know, in the 18th century, telling all these pioneers, listen, don't cross the Mississippi River. You know, it costs too much money. We don't want to do it. But of course we want to do it, if for no other reason than to simply know what's out there, even aside from all the potential practical benefits of knowing what's in the western half of the country.
And when you say we want to know what's out there, that includes life. Not just past life on Mars, but the potential of life, I don't know, on Enceladus, for example?
Yes, there could be life elsewhere in the solar system, you know, one of the moons of Saturn. That could be. And to find that would also be extraordinarily interesting, because it would tell you right away, hey, look, life got cooked up on some other world right here in our own solar system. So that suggests that life is probably a very common phenomenon.
This show is thanks to the reliable talent of senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. I am Molly Bentley, the executive producer for Big Picture Science.
And I'm Seth Shostak, senior astronomer at the SETI Institute. We'd like to give a big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters.
The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science, that considers what research would be lost under proposed NASA budget cuts, is called NASA Under the Axe.
Hello, we want to recommend our podcast, don't we, Rowan?
We do, Penny. It's called The World, the Universe and Us from New Scientist, and it's your essential weekly dose of science and wonder, hosted by me, Dr. Rowan Hooper.
And me, Dr. Penny Sarte. Each week we talk to the scientists in the news and draw on New Scientist's unparalleled depth of reporting to put the stories that matter into context. It's brain food.
It's brain food. It feeds your brain and your curiosity, and it's a dose of optimism.
The World, the Universe and Us. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
From the creators of the popular science show with millions of YouTube subscribers comes the Minute Earth podcast. Every episode of the show dives deep into a science question you might not even know you had. But once you hear the answer, you'll want to share it with everyone you know. Why do rivers curve? Why did the T-Rex have such tiny arms? And why do so many more kids need glasses now than they used to? Spoiler alert, it isn't screen time. Our team of scientists digs into the research and breaks it down into a short, entertaining explanation, jam-packed with science facts and terrible puns. Subscribe to Minute Earth wherever you like to listen.
trusting and believing in the miracles of love. Even if it seems to be so hard to reach for the dream that is so far, never lose your faith in love when you're up against all odds. But still you will pull through. Hold on to your hopes and dreams, and there's nothing that you cannot do. Whoa. Up against all odds, we were standing up against all odds, trusting and
and even more.